KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
You know, sadly, it seems like every couple days, weeks, months, we're faced with another one of these discussions about the impact. It's more than just social media. The impact of technology, how easy it is to spread information, how easy it is to spread bad information. An example being the terrorist who live streamed the murder of 49 people in New Zealand last week. And the relatively low tech it requires, a cell phone and the Facebook app, for lack of better terms, that you can broadcast this potentially to hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people.
Yeah.
And how easy it is to do that.
Right.
The flip side is the tech companies out there realize they bear some responsibility in this. And I will still argue, I think they're trying to figure out where and where the line is for them. But Facebook, YouTube, Twitter all spent the weekend trying to block, take down, change their algorithms in some way, shape, or form so that you wouldn't see that video of the terrorist attack in New Zealand.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is it's not just taking down the terrorist himself broadcasting it, which he did live. That's
just one guy.
Right, that they can do. It's the 1.5 million Facebook users who keep posting the video again and again on their own page. That's what they're trying to catch up with, is they find it, they take it off, and then someone does it again. Or
somebody shares it.
Different guy does it. It's incredible. It's us. And there's a group of people out there, some percentage of the population. They want to see it. They want to broadcast it. They want to be part of the conversation. I don't know what the desire is here.
I guess, and I'm struck in the middle here, and I will acknowledge it. I would never post it on one of my social media channels.
Right.
I just wouldn't. I wouldn't post a video of people dying.
Yeah.
You know, contrary to popular belief, I have some lines, okay, that I wouldn't cross. But is there... are we doing a disservice to some level if we are sanitizing ourselves? I've heard this argument when it comes to war, that we send young men and women off to war. And the video we get, you know, from embedded journalists is some Humvees trekking along, and there's some dust getting kicked up and a bunch of soldiers looking fit as a fiddle there,
right,
and waving the American flag. And we're like, all right, they're fighting war.
Right.
That's not war.
No.
That's decidedly not what war looks like.
That's Hollywood war.
And are we more likely to be in favor of war if we don't actually see the impact of war? Using the example of the shooting in New Zealand, are you more likely to be in favor of whatever it is if you don't actually see the impact of it?
Yeah.
Whether it's guns, whether it's extremism, whatever it might be, that if we sanitize it to a certain level, are we also doing ourselves a disservice?
Yeah. No, the video of it and the presentation of it makes a big difference. In World War II, going to your example, Bruce, in World War II, the government worked with Hollywood, or Hollywood with the government, to present a sanitized version of World War II. It was all about...
no blood.
Yeah.
No guts.
It was patriotism and honor.
Right.
And we were going to be here saving the world, which we were. But right, no blood, no guts, no pain, no nothing. And I think that changed. And there was a lot of support for World War II, right? The entire country was in support of it. I think that changed for Vietnam when the news stations were there showing unedited footage of what was going on in Vietnam.
I think of that classic picture of the naked Vietnamese girl, you know, clothes would burned off by the napalm. I think of these images,
right,
like, wow.
Yeah, and it has an amazing effect on the population to see that. And I think that's the same thing here. That's the problem I'm having with this. Are we better off seeing how bad this is, seeing the evil that this terrorist did?
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe that wakes us up. Maybe that says, hey, white nationalism is a real issue. These school shootings are a real issue. If we see that, maybe, because we know about it, we're obviously aware that this is happening, but if you see the carnage itself,
okay,
does that make us react differently?
Barry Markson in for Pamela Hughes. Okay, I got a for instance.
All right.
We haven't planned this. So my life is not planned. I can't imagine anybody thinks the show is. Newtown, Connecticut.
Yeah.
If you would have seen the video of the first responders, the first people in those classroom of children, seeing murdered kids lying on the floor.
The body cam footage of what the officer saw.
For example.
Yeah.
The first people in the room.
Right.
Would it have changed people's minds?
Would it have caused actual gun discussions and legislation?
Something more meaningful to come out of it.
Right.
As opposed to the parents holding up the school picture of their children.
Right.
When they were alive.
Which was heartbreaking by itself.
Without a doubt.
Right. But would that change?
It was terrible seeing the pain that those parents and those family members were going through. No doubt.
Yeah. I
if you'd have saw the dead bodies of children, would it have changed the way people look at some of these things? I don't know.
I argue that it would.
Really?
I argue that it would. And I used this example earlier, but
okay.
President Trump is a perfect example of this with the Syrian war. He was always against the war. He wanted to pull out of Syria. And then, if you remember, a couple of years ago, the chemical attacks in Syria on the kids and on their families.
Assad was attacking these people with these chemical weapons,
and
gas.
And we saw it. I mean, there was video of it as it happened right afterwards.
People dying in front of your face.
Exactly. Seeing little kids. Mm-hmm. And the president spoke of that, I thought touchingly, actually. Give him some credit here. And that spurred him
to
action.
But it took the video, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
Because Assad had been gassing Syrians for a while. And the rest of the world went, man, we're going to write him a sternly worded email if he keeps this up.
Obama
right?
had the line in the sand and
didn't,
all that.
A lot of work that did. Red lines didn't work.
Right.
When you saw the video of children gasping for breath, dying from a chemical attack, you said, okay. Now we're going to do something. Is it the same thing with these shootings? Is it the same things with these terror attacks?
Yeah.
Do you take white nationalism more seriously if you see 49 people lying dead in a church?
Right.
Because this guy thinks, you know, the white race is under attack and he needs to eradicate everybody that's not like him.
Yeah, if you see a white nationalist racist walking around with a gun shooting, literally shooting innocent people, children.
Women and children.
I told you I read that report of the video. I haven't watched the video.
Right.
There were women cowering. They were shot. They're crying on the ground. They're begging no. And he walks right up to them and shoots them again.
Yeah.
If we see that, will that change the reaction to white nationalists? Will that change the reaction to some gun issues? I mean, this was in New Zealand.
Right,
obviously.
But here's the debate. And they're in the ice of debate because the social media platforms are saying, Barry Markson, you can have that discussion. You just can't have it on our website.
Because they get the uproar of people.
You can't have
them.
It on Facebook. You can't have it on YouTube. You can't have it on Twitter. You guys can have the debate. Just don't use us to do it.
Right. People love all those social media platforms to be open and you can put anything on it until it's something they don't want to see.
And then they're
how could you have
shocked
this,
and outraged.
How could you have this out here for people to see?
Yeah.
Yeah. My kids don't need to see this. Whatever it is. And I get that. They're right about that too. And there should be a warning. People are seeking this out. You're not going
obviously.
You are not going to stumble upon the video of what
by
happened
accident.
In New Zealand. You're going to be looking for it. So if you're looking for it, if you're saying this is news, I'm so upset. I want to feel this. I want to see what this really is. Should you have that option to do that in this day and age?
In this day and age,
yeah.
I suppose you can find it. There's probably places that have it, although they're making it harder and harder. I thought this was interesting, and this gets into what kind of power do you want to give these tech companies? We'll use YouTube as an example. If you went on YouTube and went to look for this video, YouTube, they admit this is not a secret.
Right.
YouTube said that in response, they automatically rejected any footage of the violence. It didn't make it past their filters. They suspended the ability to sort or filter searches by an upload date, and they made sure any searches of the event only pulled up results from what they call authoritative news sources like the New Zealand Herald or USA Today. They were making an editorial decision that regardless of what you search for, here's the information we're going to give you.
Right.
I understand why they're doing it, but I count me as one that there's a moment of pause in there going, well, where else do you do that?
Right.
And when else would you use that level of control to say, regardless of what you're searching for, here's what we're going to give you.
Yeah, and they're in a tough spot because there are people who think, a lot of people, who think those companies should be doing that on a regular basis, that they should be censoring what's available for us to see, just like the news network censor what we see.
Yeah, and
That there should have they should be a standard of what they broadcast as if they are a news operation. And that's not what they are. That isn't what these things are. Now, there are things I think maybe everybody would agree we shouldn't see. Maybe some people would say, put it all out there. Let me make the decision. For me, this is different than a kid burning a cat. I don't need to see that. This is news. This happened.
Agreed.
This is
real.
Right. And I think
it has a ripple effect. It affects a lot of other things, right?
Yeah. And I think we should see it. And I'll be honest with you. And I'm not saying this in a political way, one way or the other. I think if President Trump were to see this, I think his reaction to the white nationalism that most everyone agrees there's a rise of that around the world.
It's obvious.
Maybe that changes. Maybe if he sees it's not just rhetoric, it's real. And if he sees a little girl who's being shot by a guy, you know, by this man, maybe that is
because of her religion, because of her race, because of her ethnicity.
Yeah. If he sees a woman lying on the ground begging for her life and the guy just shoots her, he literally walked up to women and shot him in the face. I mean, it is as gruesome as you could possibly think, but you and I talking about it like this is not the same as seeing it. And I don't want to see it because I don't want that image in my mind.
I wonder if it would change the way he talks about it.
Yeah.
Because he's much more angry at Nancy Pelosi, who he calls Nancy. he's much more angry at Democrats, liberals,
right,
Mexicans pouring over the border than he is at white nationalists who are actually out there murdering people.
And that's why I brought up the Syria thing. He saw it and it changed his. He said it. He said that changed my reaction to it. And I give him credit for that. I mean, that's he discussed the real visceral effect it had on him seeing it.
Speaking of Trump, he spent the weekend rage tweeting, just like your drunk grandpa does sometimes. And one of the targets of his rage tweeting was the late Arizona Senator John McCain. We'll play you some of not only his comments, but Meghan McCain, John McCain's daughter's response to it.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Everyone's favorite drunk uncle and conspiracy theorist. The guy who forwards you articles they read on Breitbart about what's really going on. Open your eyes, man.
The conspiracy memes.
Yeah. Donald Trump spent the weekend rage tweeting. Was it some 50? Literally, they counted.
50 tweets. 30 original ones. He retweeted himself. He retweeted other people. Yeah. 50 tweets in Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
And he's the president of the United States.
Yeah. Well, he has no friends. His family can't stand him. And he sits alone in the White House binge-watching Fox News and rage-tweeting.
Yeah.
I mean, we obviously, it is what it is.
You're absolutely
right. You call
it
whatever you want, but that is what it is. Attempting to right wrongs, fix slights, and by the way, pathologically lie his way through things like he did in attacking the late Senator John McCain, which he did over the weekend.
The president accusing McCain of, quote, spreading the fake and totally discredited dossier, a document that alleges links between the Trump campaign and Russian officials, and also claims that Russians allegedly have compromising information on Trump. In his tweet, quoting these comments from Ken Starr on Fox News.
John McCain was an American hero. This is unfortunately a very dark stain.
Yeah. Besides the fact that and again, what a shock, the pathological liar is lying in his tweets, that the dossier is not discredited. As a matter of fact, the dossier has been proven in a court of law to be the number I heard is 75% to 80% of it has been proven to be true. The rest of it has not been proven to be false. There's just no evidence that it's true.
Right.
But it's not. There's no evidence that it's not true.
Right.
We'll leave that as undecided. But the idea that it is somehow discredited is only in Cult 45 land where it's been discredited.
And it's not obviously not discredited. There are people who have pled guilty to crimes based on this, or people who are indicted and facing trials based on this.
They are sitting in jail, Barry, as we speak, based on the Steele dossier.
Right.
Or the discredited fake Steele dossier that landed them in prison.
But the investigation that followed and confirmed that much of what was in there was true. You're absolutely right.
He
lied about McCain, because McCain didn't release this before the election. McCain never gave it to the media. McCain got this information that said the president may be compromised, and he did what he should do, which is give it to the FBI.
He was a concerned American. He happened to be a senior senator, and he was worried at the information that was given to him, and he passed it along to law enforcement.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Anybody's supposed to do, but certainly a sitting senator, and that's exactly what he did. And he just has something up his about John McCain. And to me, this is what flashed in my mind when this happened. It's the funeral. It's the
fact that people cared about John McCain and don't care about him.
And because in my mind, President Trump will never have the type of funeral. He'll have a state funeral. He's a president. It's never going to be like John McCain's funeral. It'll never be the same because people don't have that level of caring or feeling about it.
And the reality is that Senator McCain still had more class and respect in his pinky finger than the entire Trump bloodline ever will. But Meghan McCain came to the defense of her father originally on the Twitter machine.
Meghan McCain firing off at Trump for attacking her father, tweeting, "No one will ever love you the way they love my father. I wish I had been given more Saturdays with him. Maybe spend yours with your family instead of on Twitter obsessing over mine."
Well, we think it's obvious the family doesn't want to spend any time with him, as evidenced by, "I'm alone in the White House." Ronery. I'm so Ronery. So he rage tweets, watches Fox News and retweets conspiracy theorists, racists, and you know, I had this thought the other day. They're trying to compare the shooter in New Zealand to Trump, and I don't know if there's a connection between that. And I will acknowledge that what motivates terrorists or criminals to do things is irrelevant. But I do think there is a solid argument to debate. I don't know if Trump is a racist. I do not.
Yeah,
I know that racists think Trump is a racist.
Right,
and isn't that just as bad?
Right.
I mean, isn't that if white nationalists in Phoenix thought that something I said on the radio was in support of them, I would reconsider what the hell I just said.
That's right.
I went, well, apparently I have gone about this the right way because I think those are a bunch of buffoons.
Right.
You know,
when after Charlottesville, David Duke stands up and says, "We couldn't have expected anything more from
the president." You're doing it wrong.
Yeah. That's a problem.
I don't know if Trump's racist.
That's
a boy,
problem.
Racists certainly think he's racist.
I got to tell you, though, Lindsey Graham, I'd have to say this. What a friend. I mean, he was McCain's best friend.
Friend in the Senate.
And
in life,
and
possibly.
And just won't stand up to Trump, even when somebody's talking about this guy that was your best friend for decades. It's amazingly. Meghan McCain calls him Uncle Lindsey. I wonder if that's a little strained right now. He refuses to criticize Trump because he's afraid of the effect it'll have on the election.
You'll see how Lindsey Graham is viewed in history, and the closer he gets to Trump, the worse he's going to be viewed in history.
I think you're right. It's the worst kind of politics.
Totally agree. Where your principles and your morals and your beliefs don't have anything to do with you're afraid of the orange man tweeting at you.
Even your friends.
Yeah.
Even your friends.
A large number of migrants were dropped off at bus stations, churches over the weekend. Tens of thousands this year alone. What's going on and what can be done? We're going to talk to KTR's Peter Seymour, who's in the middle of this discussion, coming up next.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
So we know there are numbers to back it up that hundreds on any given weekend, thousands in any given month, of migrants are, I'm going to use the term, unceremoniously dropped off at places around the state.
Maybe there should be a ceremony.
A little pomp and circumstance.
There should be. All right.
Joining us right now in studio from our KTR news team is Peter Seymour. And Peter, you spent the morning kind of tracking down and talking to some of the principals involved in this. What we hear about hundreds and or thousands, depending on the time period you want to say, of migrant families, men, women, and children being released into the public.
Right. So I got to speak with the director of ICE here in Phoenix. His name is Henry Lucero. He's talked to KTAR before. He talked with us again just this morning. He tells me that, you know, right now, 4,100 adults, single adults, not families, are in ICE custody at this moment. And he says that because the families that do cross in Arizona, well, there are no processing facilities for families, so they have to be taken out of state, or you know, they might be taken to San Antonio, or they might just be released and said, "You're on your own." You have three ways of getting to San Antonio, where there's a family shelter. You can either, we can just let you out the door right here. We can get you to a bus station, or you can. I forgot the third option. He told me. I'm blanking. I can't believe this.
Was this some of the advocacy groups or the churches?
That's right. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Good. You can go to an NGO, church, advocacy group, anything, a shelter like that. So we'll take you to one of the three. And, of course, we asked him about the thing with Greyhound, and Greyhound saying, "Hey, ICE, don't you bring anybody here."
We're not going to be your drop-off point.
Exactly. Well, so basically the way Mr. Lucero responded was, we can still take him to a bus station, but it's up to Gray. He didn't say this part, but in essence, it's up to Graham to close the doors on them.
So Henry Lucero, again, the head of ICE here in Arizona, the region?
Phoenix.
In Phoenix, talked about the law and really the constraints they're dealing with.
If the law changes and, hey, you're going to be detained, you may be able to stay here if an immigration judge allows it, but when we see the process go through completion, and we're specifically talking about asylum claims, we see an immigration judge only grant that 10 to 15% of all cases. So now you're telling someone, if you get apprehended and you go through the system, you only have a 10 or 15% chance of being able to legally remain in the United States. You're probably going to see the numbers drop off of people coming.
So he's saying that that there needs to be more of a PR campaign in Central America to discourage these people from coming, saying your chance of being getting the asylum protection is low?
That would only come after what he really wants. He wants Congress to change the law. Currently, people can only be detained for about 20 days. If you were to extend that length of duration allowed, this would tell the asylum seekers, okay, well, you might be in detention for months, maybe up to a year. You'll be stuck behind bars, and even then you might not have a chance of getting to stay in the U.S. legally. So right now, again, with the limited amount of time that ICE and all these federal agencies have to process people, the people are taking obviously good risks, good chances. 98% of the time they can stay in this country because they're just left out into the wind.
We're talking to KTR News' Peter Seymour.
So Peter, is it a small percentage when this does go to an immigration judge? What is the percentage of these migrants who can stay on the asylum claim?
Basically, it still is 10 to 15%. But the real point here is that if you had more time in detention, that you know the immigrants would say, well, I'm not going to stay that long, even though my chances won't improve. I'm just going to, you know, I'll chance it in my country, because right now, even with a 98% chance of them just staying in the country legally or illegally, that's what they're looking at. They're not really looking how fast they can get through the system at this point. But if the law were to change, then they would have to take a second look.
So he wants more beds. He wants what, tent city down there where we can just house people and keep them there so that there's more of a this. They're constantly trying to find ways to create a deterrent to showing up.
I would think that could possibly help. He's just hoping that, again, you know, if you can show them that, you know, you're going to be stuck, and yes, it would take more beds, it would take more detention space, then hopefully that'll be enough to say it's not worth coming here. There was another point that I wanted to bring up, too. You know, people are asking, whose job is it really to take care of these migrants?
Yeah.
And you know what? I asked them that point blank.
When you ask the question of, is the federal government legally obligated? I would answer no, that the federal government is not appropriated to house people that they've decided to release. And legally, we cannot. So these non-governmental organizations, these faith-based organizations that are helping, are doing it because they want to help and they think it's the right thing to do. I think it's admirable that they're doing that and helping people that are in need, but also they're not legally obligated and it's probably not sustainable.
I don't disagree with Mr. Lucero. It's not the job of the federal government to house you while you're waiting for the process, the legal process to move forward, regardless of what your chances are in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does then go to, well, then whose is it?
Yeah.
And it really is nobody's. And that's what he's trying to say. I mean, think of it this way.
It's just purgatory. You're in the middle of it.
Exactly. If any one of us three were to go to Honduras, let's say, and say, you know, we're going to wait here for our asylum hearing or whatever, well, I don't think any government, Honduras or otherwise, would say, yeah, we'll put you up until you get through our system. No. We're on our own as human beings no matter where we go.
Are we getting a sense that the NGOs, the non-government organizations, the faith-based organizations, the advocacy groups, are they being stretched to the max? I mean, can they just not deal with the number of people coming across the border?
That's what I've been hearing, you know, and Mr. Lucero brought that up with me as well. He says, you know, there are some days where he's ready to send 200 migrants to these shelters, these NGOs that can put them up, and at the very last minute they'll say, you know, we don't have enough volunteers today. We can't receive them after all. We're so sorry. You got to do something else. And so they can't go in there. So the NGOs and these nonprofits, they're at the whim of their donors and the money they can raise to house these people, keep them safe as best as they can.
You can see what a conundrum this is, because the law says they have to release them after a certain number of days. It doesn't say you have to release them to this place.
Right.
So some of them, I'm assuming, just end up walking out the front door.
But the NGOs also say, the churches say, they wish they got more notice, that if ICE would just give them a little more notice, they could have staffing there. They could be prepared for the drop-off, at least. It's the numbers are still overwhelming, so it's always going to be a problem. But they could work a little bit better together, I guess.
Yeah, communication is always tough in a stressful situation like this.
So is the only way to really cut this down to have a law that says we're only going to accept a certain number of asylum seekers a year, or something where we can just shut them down so that they show up after we get our 10,000 asylum seekers? Everybody else after unless it's an extreme circumstance, can't come in?
I hear you. And then you get into the – I understand where you're going with this, but do you think that people who took a – and I apologize, I don't know the miles – 1,500-mile, 2,000-mile journey to get here are going to turn around because you told them the list was full?
Well, we wouldn't let them in. I mean, that's I'm not saying we should do that.
But then that would encourage them to enter illegally.
Well, that's true.
But you see what I'm saying? After you've made that journey, are you going to turn around and march back?
Right.
I would just argue maybe they're not.
Yeah.
You know?
Or is Mexico going to let them stay there now? I mean, what happens?
You know, there are things we could be doing in their home countries to mitigate this, but we are not. By the way, we're just flat not doing it.
Yeah.
And we're making it harder in their home countries for them to apply for asylum, for them to have this discussion, and many of them feel their only opportunity is to show up at a border checkpoint somewhere.
You know, Germany's taking all these Syrian refugees. Maybe we should just truck some of the Mexican asylum or Honduran asylum seekers over
to
Germany.
Truck them across the ocean.
There you go. Bring them over.
Maybe, maybe fly them or something.
Peter Samar from KTR News, thank you very much for
that. Glad to be here, gentlemen. Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll have more of that up at KTR.com as well. His conversation with Henry Lucero, the head of ICE here in Phoenix. Good night. Well, we're that much closer. We are counting down the hours till basically the entire country shuts down because of college basketball.
Yes.
March Madness is upon us. We're talking about that next on Arizona's news station.
Arizona's news station. KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
We'll have to take you back in the way, way back machine. Back in like the 1900s, when you kids today, like super producer Stevie Z, he's practically an infant. He wouldn't have known that employers tried to discourage you from spending the month of March and now going into April from sitting around and watching basketball all day, filling out your brackets and hoping you will win, as opposed to actually doing the job they're paying you to do. I think a lot of employers have just thrown up their hands now and just embraced it.
Yeah, I think they do too. I think they make it into a kind of a bonding moment. There's the internal pools. They know they're there. People get together and watch the game. And I think that's the right attitude. If you try to fight it, it's not going to work anyway, especially you can watch it on your phone now. I mean, it's everywhere. So even if you say,
you know, it used to be you had to find a TV.
Right. I mean, now you can watch it on your computer at the office. Maybe they don't want you to use the bandwidth. You can watch it on your phone. People go to lunch. They don't come back.
I mean, never show back up.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's definitely, you said this earlier, it's, you know, guys who are going to get a vasectomy, this is the week.
That's not a joke.
I know.
Statistically, like, more men get vasectomies this week than any other week of the year.
It's perfect.
And I never figured out why. And I go, oh, my God. So they can spend 4 days lying around, recovering from their vasectomy, with the excuse of, I'll just watch college basketball.
Just have a bag of frozen peas, and they're ready to go.
Oh, my Lanta.
Just keep everything, keep everything cool. That's all, Bruce.
I did not need that. But there is something to be said for the fact that there is lost productivity in this. I mean, there is and I just think it's funny how work has become. You and I, Barry and I, are both old enough to remember. Again, we worked back in radio in the 1900s. I can remember... Again, like Stevie Z won't even understand what we're talking about. I can remember we had a rule about no cell phones at work.
Yes.
We had a rule you couldn't make personal calls on company phones. Remember that?
I do remember that.
You had to
I
worked for one company. You had to like input a code every time you went to, when you picked up the phone, before you get a dial tone,
right.
You had to put your code in, and that meant they knew whoever you were calling.
Right.
And so if you were calling your mom every day to speak for 3 hours, it would show up on the bill, and they go, Bruce, why are you calling your mom every day for 3 hours?
Let alone long distance. You try to call long distance. It was a whole cost to
CBZ,
that.
CBZ, we used to have something called long distance calling, where it cost more money to call people who weren't around the corner from you.
Yeah.
But now, and again, I worked for employers that had like, you know, hey, none of this watching. We're here. We're doing a job.
Right.
None of this watching basketball. Can't have a 3.5 hour lunch today. Yep. You know, they tried to fight against it, and it feels like just the people finally won. Can we take this against corporate America? We finally won a battle.
I think we did win a battle. It always cracks me up though when you ever been with the guys, you're looking out the window and you're watching the construction workers outside, they're all standing around talking, and you say, man, those guys are just on permanent breaks.
Permanent break.
But if you work in an office, you're always
on
a break. You're constantly. Don't
give me this, you're working 8 hours a day.
Not a
chance. I'm walking by you right now, you're on Amazon shopping, like, oh, look at the shoes on Zappos.
That's
you're not working.
Your friend's sending you a meme to
look
at.
That. Oh, those aren't real kitties. Look at that. You're not working.
But this basketball thing is going to be exciting. ASU game's Wednesday. The first play-in game now against St. John's. Wednesday night at 6.
The purist in me and the Wildcat in me will say, not really part of the tournament.
I'm with you on that. I'm an ASU guy. I mean, I'm glad they're there. I'm excited about it. But if you don't
win
this
part of the 64.
If you're not part of the 64, you didn't make the tournament. But officially, they say they're in. So... I mean, the tournament
is going to keep expanding this. I mean, we're pretty soon we're going to, like, we have 128 teams in the tournament. Like, it's going to start in February. We'll end up in April. Just do nothing but that.
It's a weird thing though, because these four play-in teams that have ASU and St. John's, the four teams that are playing on Wednesday, they're ASU and St. John's are ranked 11th. So if they come in, they're an 11th seed.
They don't come in at a 16, right? Because the reality is the rankings are a little bit crazy to begin with.
Right.
The 16 seeds are patsies,
right?
For lack of better terms, they're people that win these
little conferences.
Ivy League conferences or whatever. Right. We know they're going to get beat like a redheaded stepchild,
right,
for God's sakes. You know, rented mule time when they have to go up against the number one and lose by 70.
Exactly. But ASU's, it's going to be interesting. I got to tell you, this ASU team, they can win some games.
They could.
Kansas. They have a good team. They just have to show up. They're outside shooting has to hit, and they have to stay focused. If they can,
you're
do
much
that,
more focused on ASU than I am. So I have a question for you.
Yes.
Are they a better home team or away team?
They're a better home team, but I'm not sure it was that much of a difference.
Okay.
It's a focus.
I'm just saying,
issue.
Is it tough for them to go on the road and win?
Yeah. No, it's tough for them to go a lot of places and win, including home. It's just been a struggle. It's been a fun year. I want them to win Wednesday, win their first round. After that,
everything's gravy?
Everything is gravy after that.
That's the difference between you and me.
If you don't win the whole thing, you're not interested.
Wildcat fans, when you're in the tournament, you expect to win the tournament. ASU just hopes to get there.
How odd is it that ASU is in and U of A is not?
Yeah. Oh,
when was the last time that happened?
I couldn't. Well, they're again technically not in. Got to win Wednesday. Got to win Wednesday before you can start bringing up stats. Okay, we're going with recent history here. All right. Barry Markson doing an excellent job. Thank you for being here today for Pamela.
Thanks, Bruce. I enjoyed it.
We do appreciate it. We look through the double pane bulletproof glass. We've got DJ Tommy Two Tone, super producer Stevie Z, and Ashley Flood.